Bishop Tutu was there for the independence, and he said, "Our God is a God of surprises." Who would have thought? He had been in Namibia just 2 years earlier. And surely when we were there in Namibia in 1988, it was completely beyond question that, I mean, no one thought that Namibia would be independent. What, 2 years later? Just an amazing thing happened. Now, I'm not sure whether I should go into some of the history of Namibia. Just suffice it to say that Namibia had been occupied since the middle 1800s by Germans, by the first the German missionaries, then the German army, and then the German merchants, delivering sort of a 1-2-3 punch to the Namibian people. Life under the Germans was very, very difficult. Namibians had virtually no rights at all and were subjected to the loss of their land, the loss of their possessions, the loss of their freedom. And then South Africa came in 1915, at the time of the First World War, and continued the treatment of the Namibian people and codified it, really. Namibia was occupied as though it were one of the provinces of South Africa. And so the same apartheid laws that affected and affect the lives of blacks in South Africa came to be in force in Namibia. The Namibian people did not have the right to own land, did not have the right to an education. As in South Africa, education was free and compulsory for the whites and not compulsory at all for the blacks, and very, very inferior. Namibians did not have free speech. They could be arrested, tortured, imprisoned without charges ever being filed. But all of this changed, supposedly, on March 21st of this year, when Namibia became the Republic of Namibia, with the through the efforts of the United Nations, through the efforts of the world community, and most of all through the stubborn endurance and suffering of the Namibian people. They had won their independence. The topic that we are going to deal with today is, what now? What does the future hold for this new nation? And I sat down at the typewriter this afternoon. I was going to make a list of the pluses and the minuses for Namibia right now. And I did really well on the problems facing Namibia. And then I got a few pluses here. But I thought I would just talk about some of these issues. And please, this is a really small group. We can just pick up on any ideas that I may have, or if you have any questions or contributions, or if you think of another problem we could add to the list. I thought we'd start with problems faced by the new country. First of all, and these are not in order necessarily of importance, they're in the order that I thought of them as I sat at the typewriter today. Namibia has a debt of about $300 million. Now, where did they get this debt? Well, these were mainly loans that South Africa received in order to maintain its control over the Namibian people. It cost a great deal of money to maintain the war effort in Namibia. At one time, and this is several years ago, I saw the figure of $1 million a day, which I'm sure went up from there. Then one of the things they had done in Namibia was to establish duplicating medical and health systems for every one of the ethnic groups in Namibia. One of South Africa's ploys, both at home and in Namibia, was to divide and conquer, to increase, to agitate, to the ethnic differences, to pit one group against another. And in Namibia, one real clear way they did this was to have, for example, a separate educational system for each one of the ethnic groups. So if you were a Herero living in the central part of Namibia, you had the Herero educational structure and all the bureaucracy that goes with an educational structure. If you were Nama, also there, you had the whole Nama administration. And this A created lots of animosity, lots of tension between, for example, Herero and Nama people, because in one area, Nama children were given textbooks for a certain course, the Herero children weren't. Or differences like that were built into the system so that it caused a lot of tension. But it also cost a lot of money. So South Africa had been increasingly borrowing money to fund their operation in Namibia. Now there's some question, certainly in world opinion, whether the Namibian people now are liable for these debts, this incredible sum of money that was used to keep them oppressed and suffering, now they are expected to pay it. That is still, it's still undecided what will happen there. Some economists argue that not to pay it will damage their credibility, their economic credibility in the world, and make it very difficult to get loans. I don't know what will happen. That's one of the problems. Land redistribution is a very, very major problem facing the Namibian government. There are 4,000 white farmers. There are probably 800,000 black subsistence farmers. The 4,000 have nearly all of the decent land in Namibia. And when you think that the title to this land, the title of this property, in a sense, going way back, depended on driving the Namibians from the land. So in a sense, there is the feeling that it is stolen land. And certainly one of the expectations of the Namibian people is that after independence, their land will be restored to them. That's something they've been fighting for. That's something they will agitate for. And yet, the SWAPO government knows that to do any kind of massive redistribution of the land would alienate, obviously, the white farmers, who right now seemingly, I mean, there is some goodwill, perhaps, if not goodwill, at least an agreement to cooperate. And also it would undercut the agricultural economy of the country. So it's really a dilemma. How fast can this redistribution happen? One of the suggestions has been that farmers be asked, the large farmers, to voluntarily give up some of their land, or if there is land that they're not using, that make this available to the government. So far, the government has put no pressure whatsoever, other than asking for voluntary gifts of land. Now, if the government should decide it needed to purchase, it needed more land, it would purchase it. But it's really a dilemma. How long will the people be patient with the government? Because certainly many, many people kind of had, many, many Namibians, I think, had the unrealistic expectation that right after independence, they would be restored to their land. One of the things the government is trying to do is to give, for the first time in Namibia, aid to these subsistent farmers. I noticed they have developed a new mahango seed. Mahango is the millet, which is the daily food of the people in the north. And this is a new type of mahango that produces much more or something. They're giving that.
Where was that developed? Was that up in...
I don't know where it was developed.
Huh.
But it is now going to be distributed. Also, there is a plan to, as soon as possible, provide water and electricity to the northern part, which is the big rural part. In the north of Namibia is the only really excellent agricultural land, because excellent land, anyone who's been there and seen it.
It grows food
when it gets rain.
When they
looks pretty desolate.
Unbelievably, it's nothing but sand. And then between the months of December, January, February, if you get rain, suddenly things turn green and they're able to grow the millet that they use daily. The other area under farming is the large, large white farms have black workers, and these are some of the poorest, least educated, most disempowered people in all of Namibia, because on the white farm, the farmer is still, even now after independence, pretty much has life or death control over his workers.
Do they treat them as badly as South African farmers?
Yes, I think. I don't know how badly South African farmers do, but it's literally, it has been
slavery.
A life and death. Yeah, it's a slavery. And there's certainly strong evidence that most of the farm workers who did vote, voted according to the wishes of the farmer in the last election. So they're trying to draft some sort of legislation that will protect the rights of these folks out on the isolated farms. Housing shortages. All over Namibia there's tremendous shortage of housing. I was just reading that in the single-sex quarters in Katatura. Katatura is the black township just outside of the capital city, where traditionally now the blacks have had to live outside the city limits. And so they live in this impoverished area known as Katatura. And the worst part of Katatura probably has been these dormitories and barracks where the workers whose families are in the north, they come down and they live there in Katatura. And I noticed the Katatura barracks had been built to house 2,000 people, and there are now 10,000 living in them. And that's just one example of the housing shortage. The new person in the cabinet, in the government in charge of housing, is the only woman in the cabinet, a medical doctor, Libertine Amadila. And I have really been impressed following her actions since her appointment. She is traveling all over the country, looking at the conditions, telling the people she understands how bad the housing situation is, but telling them there just simply is no money at this time, and encouraging the self-help projects. There's, for example, and she's explaining, in exile, she made the bricks with which she built her own house, and encouraging. There is also in Katatura a committee for the homeless that has been working on brick making and building their own homes now for the last couple of years. But housing is a tremendous problem for independent Namibia. And another thing that the government has just done now is to declare that any homes in these townships that are older than 20 years old will be now sold to the residents, the people who have been living in them, for 200 rand, about $100 or so, which is a tremendous thing. The white government had promised over and over and over that if you pay us, these people paid enormous rents, enormous in terms of their income, for shacks, basically. But always the promise of the white government was, well, one day you will own these. Now the black government is carrying out that promise. And there is the hope then that at least for people living in housing that's 20 years old or older, that they will actually be able to own their homes. Education. Just as in South Africa, in Namibia, the policy was to have a special education for the blacks that did not stress the academic courses, but prepared blacks for service to the whites, actually. In Namibia, as in South Africa, the figures for Namibia were about 10 to 1, the amount of money spent on a white child's education as on a black. Now the new government the new budget provides for equal amount of dollars for each child in the country. And eventually that will have some effect, but for now, it is still true that the schools in the white areas will have the best equipment, the best, most qualified teachers. Most blacks will be unable to get transportation to the white areas. There are a lot of white schools that are becoming private schools, or have been private and are continuing to be. There's a German school in Windhoek that out in front of it is a signboard saying with an arrow, Berlin 50,000 kilometers or something.
55,000 kilometers or something.
Very much.
Keep walking in that.
Right, place. Very much oriented to Germany. I'm not sure if, the impact of Germany and the presence of German ideas and culture in Namibia is very, very strong. And it is both the good and the bad. A friend of mine, Emma Muyoro, who grew up in the center of the country in a strong German area, Hitler's birthday was a school holiday for the white children as she was growing up. And you could still, as late as early 80s, and maybe still continuing, you could buy busts of Hitler. So that's the negative side. The positive side is that the pastries that you buy in Windhoek absolutely tasted like Nuremberg, and were wrapped in the same paper in the same way. It was marvelous.
Hit for those restaurants. And German beer too.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So that's the positive side. But now we were
negative.
Yeah, the negatives do outweigh the positive. But
this education budget, Sobe, when you say that they wanted to make it the same, now, did they raise the budget for the blacks or lower the budget for the whites?
They have a unified budget that all schools are, all public schools are open to black and white. And therefore, you know, they allotted a certain amount of money for education. But the articles I'm reading say, in practical terms, it will be years before this is kind of evened out. Because still, the white people can afford to live in the white areas. Very few blacks can afford. It'll be just token blacks in the
And now that they're pushing private schools now, which the blacks can't afford.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was starting to tell about this German school. The German ambassador to Namibia came to the annual meeting of this school now and gave a speech saying, this is the law of the land now. We must modify our practices to be non-racial and so forth. He was booed and hissed, and they, within his presence, elected to that, to their board, some of the most rabid white supremacists in the country. And what will happen there, the school's been, has had big subsidies from Germany, so I don't know if that'll end now or what.
And even, did he threaten that?
I think he threatened that in his speech.
He threatened that the subsidy was going to be cut back, you know, the way diplomats do it, but eventually cut back if they didn't open up to both, to all races.
So, yeah, the education is going to be a major, there is such a desire and has been for years for education in English. And that's one of the things that folks in this country have tried to help with. We've had projects of sending textbooks and sending children's books to Namibia for the last 10 years. And it was really a thrill to walk into the library in the north and or the high school in the north and see these mountains of old mail bags and old addresses, you know, Blue Mound, Wisconsin, Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, Snowbank, North Dakota, all these. So there's a real desire among the on the part of the Namibian people to have their education in English so that they can deal with the rest of the world. Okay, poverty, unemployment. 60% of black families have a yearly income of $450. And this is in a country where prices are high. I had kind of assumed that things didn't cost so much, but the prices were quite comparable to what we pay here. And so if you figure a family living on that is not buying much meat, for example, during the year. Unemployment is about 40%. And I am not sure whether that figure even includes the large number, 43,000 refugees, people who had been in exile, came home this year, and or last in the last year, and then these former army folks, there were about 30,000 of them. So all of these people, the newspaper that we get from Namibia constantly talks of the problem of jobless people on every street corner, the problem of rising crime. And one of the factors in the rising crime certainly is all these thousands of people without jobs, and many of them with weapons.
What language is the newspaper printed in?
The one now, I can only read English. It's mostly English. It has a supplement, one sometimes in Afrikaans and sometimes in a language, Oshiwambo, which is kind of the language of the north. The Windhoek, the other newspaper, which has been strongly supportive of the government, also has published in English. And then there's a German newspaper. What is the name of that?
The Allgemeine Zeitung.
Yeah, very, very conservative. And
that's a rabid rag.
So the problems that go along with poverty. Then the Namibia's ecology is a really fragile thing. The increased desertification, I always have trouble with that word, I have to sort of work my way through it, is a tremendous problem, especially in the north of Namibia, where I have seen articles that say up to 50% of the trees were destroyed by the South African forces. They cleared vast areas so that they could watch the movements of the people. The other thing, that the other factor, is the traditional way of building your home in Namibia is to put a perimeter fence of all these young trees, you know, right next to each other, and then each individual room, again, uses walls made of, you know, trees, like, so it uses an awful lot of wood, and then firewood for cooking. One of the things that this director, Minister for Housing, also is encouraging is the use of bricks, because we've got enough sand there to make a lot of bricks. But that is one of the problems that has had tremendous impact. The drought has been terrible, and then a real impact on animals, on wildlife. In Namibia, up here toward this light blue section is Etosha Pan, which is a vast, vast, vast dry lake. Huge. Namibia is an enormous country, and that is one of the largest game parks in the world, Etosha Pan. And if there are good rains in December, January, February, the pan will actually fill with water, and then it is just teeming with wildlife. Flamingos, everything from algae to elephants, really, there. It's one of, not in terms of the numbers, but the variety of wildlife, it is supposed to be the best in southern Africa, because it has just about every species that is in that whole region. We saw giraffe and zebras, a couple types of them, elephants, rhinos, lions, wildebeest, everything is there. The Namib Desert, which runs all along the coastline here, but especially in the north, is considered perhaps one of the oldest deserts in the world. And a real fragile ecosystem there. The people who lived in Namibia before colonial times, the San people, sometimes called the Bushmen, knew how to live with this fragile system, knew what they could do, and their life was adapted to it, whereas the colonizers cared very little about this. And so there has been really an exploitation. There's been poaching in terms of the animals, overfishing. By 1930, almost the whales were almost extinct. It had been one of the biggest whaling areas off coast there. Now the fishing is greatly depleted, although Namibia hopes to reestablish it through careful regulation of the Namibian, of the fishing industry. And there they're running into a problem because of the fact that South Africa has still regains possession of Walvis Bay, which is the only deep water port in the country. It's the only port for export. South Africa insists that that bay and the fishing around it belongs to South Africa. And that's a major, it was part of, you know, South Africa was part of the British Empire. And before the Germans had claimed Namibia, the British had been down here. And in 1884, when Namibia was declared German, the Brits said, that's okay, except we are going to keep Walvis Bay. And so that was not in the negotiations process. A lot of people questioned that, but SWAPO was so eager to have some sort of agreement that they said, we will settle the Walvis Bay issue later. And that's hopefully what they're trying to do now. But in terms of regulating, declaring like a 200-mile limit and so forth, Namibia can't do that really until the whole issue of Walvis Bay is settled. And for example, Iceland now has offered to help Namibia to reestablish the fishing industry. Icelanders have good experience with fishing. But South Africa has impounded the only research boat ship that used to be docked at Walvis Bay. They've taken it down to South Africa. They won't release it. Iceland says we can't do anything until that boat is released. So that's another problem. But we're at the end of the first page of problems I thought of. Medical health. Life expectancy is about 40 years. Infant mortality, depending on the figures you see, is about 30%. So that's a tremendously high percent. In the rural areas, it doesn't exist at all. The church, the Lutherans, have had a hospital in the north of Namibia and several clinics operating out of the hospital, but it is so inadequate in terms of the population. And when we were there were 400 inpatients and 400 outpatients at the hospital on any given day, and there was one Finnish woman who was the head doctor there and had been there for years and years. And when we were there, there were three other German doctors, and at that point, no Namibian doctor. But seeing a population of a huge, huge population there.
Those are just for the blacks.
No, the whites have had excellent medical facilities. This was really brought home to us. In 1988, there was a bomb explosion at a bank in the north of Namibia. Actually, it happened the day we flew out of the country in February. And 28 or so Namibian blacks were killed in the and many, many more injured. But in the explosion, there were three or four whites injured. And they were airlifted immediately to Cape Town. Those less injured were flown to the white hospital in Windhoek, and the blacks were treated there at the local hospital. And one of the blacks injured happened to be the daughter of our host. Bishop Dumaney's daughter was burned over 80% of her body and broken limbs and so forth. And she was taken down to Windhoek to the black hospital, where at that time, if you wanted clean sheets, you brought them, where they had tremendous problems with rodents, with roaches, with mold. We had just been reading this in the newspaper about how bad the sanitary conditions were at the black hospital in Katatura. And to think of taking a burn patient into for blacks, the medical care has been terrible. Fortunately, she died after 3 or 4 days. It was just incredible suffering.
Can I ask you a question? When you say the life expectancy is 40, is that adjusted for if you survive childhood, or is that...
I don't know.
If the death is that high, then that would really skew it.
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't see a lot of people over 40 there, or you know.
It's really hard to, for me, it's very hard to tell the age.
Yeah.
I don't know. Would you have an opinion on that?
I don't know. I know another figure that's somewhat comparable, that in Africa as a whole, they give it in the low 40s. And in the world, in the low 50s, and the United States, 70. And if I say that, it gives a basis, but I still don't, that's not answering your question.
Yeah.
But I think compared to the United States, you know, it's much, much lower. Much, much lower. It's hard to tell the age because people work so hard and their lives are so tough. The women are worn out by the time they're 40, and so you can be fooled. And yet there are others who are very old, and
yeah,
it's hard to tell. But the women especially age so rapidly.
Mm-hmm. How economically feasible is it to send supplies to an area like Namibia from the United States? I just think of how many times we've seen things go to waste. You know, and but then you always wonder, is it worthwhile to ship something like that to Africa, or?
It depends on what you're shipping and who you're shipping it through. We were, for example, when we were shipping textbooks, they went through, people shipped, you know, it cost a fair amount, but they always got there. When we were given 10,000 textbooks, we knew this was beyond us. The UN Commission for Refugees shipped them to refugee camps. Now Jim has picked up, and we can pass it around, there's a group out of Minneapolis, isn't it, that
yeah.
is working specifically with a clinic that was organized by the people in response to this poor medical care. At the Lutheran Seminary there, the People's Clinic. And there's a group in Minneapolis that is raising money, sending medical supplies and so forth. One of the things that we have just been told by Shea Bali, who is the head of the Council of Churches there, was that they have run into tremendous problems now getting things through Walvis Bay. They come, but the people pay double customs on it, because they pay customs when they enter Walvis Bay, and then they say, this is the border of South Africa, so you pay customs when it enters Namibia. He said, don't send anything till we get that figured out, except money.
Because they can buy medicine from South Africa. I mean, it's not impossible. South Africa has a very modern system, so in that sense, money is more helpful.
I think that's true with almost everything, that money, because, yeah, you can buy it there. Which brings us to one of the problems, and that is the tremendous dependence on South Africa still. The rail lines run to South Africa. The port is controlled by South Africa. And so the Namibian economy is, they're still using the South African rand as their currency. I've seen articles indicating they're working hard at setting up their own banking system and their own monetary system, but that's estimated to be a couple years off yet. So while Namibia is attempting to build new markets for its goods, it still imports almost three-fourths of its food from South Africa. And so, you know, it's just tremendously dependent yet on South Africa. But let's see, what else? We're getting to the end of one of the overdependence on materials. 85% of Namibia's exports are non-renewable resources. The uranium, the diamonds, the oil, the copper, the fish, Purina cat food. I mentioned the other day, you know, we import a lot of the fish. But in terms of non-renewable resources, it's a real serious problem. So one of the things the government is talking of doing is putting a great deal of emphasis on agriculture and trying to diversify the economy. Another thing it is trying to do is meet some of the needs of the neighboring countries. An example of that is that train locomotives, the ones used in Angola and the ones used in Zambia, are both South African designed locomotives, and Zambia has been shipping theirs every 6 months. They go to South Africa for maintenance on their locomotives. Angola has been shipping them all the way to Brazil to get them repaired and back. And the Namibian folks are saying this is something that we could do here, strengthen our ties with our neighbors and relieve some of the neighbors' dependence on South Africa. You know, when you're setting up, building a nation, you have to start with everything. For example, lawyers. There are no practicing attorneys in all of this area, and the majority of the Namibians live in that area. So I, Cindy.
How are they fixed for food?
I've heard there's a real shortage. There is one newspaper photographer who plays a flute in Namibia, but beyond that, I don't know of another.
I hear a call.
But to set up the whole legal system. Now there are 80 new, they call them magistrates, and I don't know how to translate this. What is a magistrate?
It's like a justice of the peace.
Yeah, it's not a judge yet. It's a justice of the peace.
But they do have quite a bit of power if they're the only one around.
Yeah, yeah. And many of the magisterial districts have been empty because there have not been magistrates for that area. Now, 50 new magistrates were trained at the United Nations Institute for Namibia. They have come home. Perhaps 30 people have been trained in law and they are home. And I don't know why it's taken so long. Namibia is just now writing legislation that will somehow allow their qualifications to be accepted and so that they can begin practicing. But you have to start from the ground up in every single area. It's just amazing. Then underlying all of these problems is the problem of reconciliation. And that is probably the word that has been heard the most in Namibia since independence. SWAPO has pushed reconciliation over and over and over again. And in every speech almost, the president talks about reconciliation, so much so that there's a lot of murmuring about that we are placing too much emphasis on this. And this is reconciliation between white and black, you know, to allay the fears of the white minority who very much feared a takeover by a black government. And also there are apparently a lot of whites in Namibia who, like those parents at that school, are not about to be reconciled. I was just reading about a squatter camp at Marienthal. That's sort of in the southern part here. I don't know. Yeah. That is very strong AWB, this extreme right, not neo-Nazi folks there. And just within the last few weeks, they have bulldozed the homes of hundreds of Namibians. They said they needed to get rid of troublesome trees. Well, a tree in Namibia, you're sort of glad if one grows. But it clearly was an effort just to remove the black settlers there. Most of the police are still white. And that's why some Namibians are saying we've overdone the reconciliation business, because we are still seeing the head of the police, the whole police structure, basically. Still, these are the people that oppressed us under South Africa, and they're still in their jobs. So that's one area of reconciliation. The other is black with black, because as I mentioned, one of the main tactics of South Africa was to increase the divisions, increase animosities between ethnic groups. And there is certainly a lot of that going on these days. To read the reports of what's happening in the National Assembly, it's just amazing the attacks, the viciousness of the attacks of one group on another. Apparently it is somewhat like the British system where people shout. You know, if you've ever heard the recordings of, Margaret Thatcher will say something, you hear this terrible shouting. And apparently some of that goes on in the assembly in Namibia. And I was reading about a brawl the other day, and our beloved friend Zephania Kameta, who is now this Lutheran pastor who is now assistant or deputy speaker of the House, calling for order and so forth. But there is a lot of ethnic tension that will have to be resolved. Kufut, which was the most dreaded force probably of the South African army in Namibia. It was black except for the officers. And so it was a group that terrorized and sabotaged and killed and tortured Namibians. Their Kufut is just this dreaded, it means crowbar in Afrikaans, and it was there mainly to terrorize the civilian population. And now what do you do after the war when you know that the person in the next house or in the next area is responsible for the deaths of relatives? That reconciliation, I think, is going to be hard, although they are proceeding to take into the new Namibian army Swapo soldiers and soldiers who fought on the side of South Africa and are trying to bring reconciliation that way. Another area of reconciliation is that during the last couple years, it has increasingly become apparent that Swapo also detained and tortured people that it felt were spies, Namibian people. And Swapo has not addressed that issue sufficiently and has said that's in the past, now we must reconcile. But there are a lot of folks who feel either who feel this way or who for political reasons say no, Swapo has to account for the people who have disappeared. Swapo has to publicly apologize and punish those who were responsible. So that's a real divisive issue that hasn't been dealt with. Are there more negatives that people think of, more problems?
Well, I think one negative that we know, and we're going to bring it up, is the fact that the United States has not offered that much aid, and that I've forgotten the figures, I'm sure you've got them, that Sam Nioma and the people in asking money from the donor agencies didn't get what they were hoping to get.
We wrote to our congressman and complained about.
What's the latest figure you have?
The amount of money.
They started with 500,000. Yeah. Now they've gone to 10. Is there more?
They started with 500,000, then they raised it to 10 million, but I have not heard of anything promised further than that. I haven't ever seen what that congressman alluded to in that letter to you. The donors conference raised about 200 million in pledges. A large percentage of that from Scandinavian countries who have been very, very strong in supporting liberation groups all over Southern Africa and supporting refugees and so forth. They have done a tremendous job. Now, on the plus side, they did inherit $32 million worth of UN equipment. I mean, every million counts, I say. That was in the form of trucks, office supplies, communication supplies. And they are joining with regional groups, regional trade groups, and now the European Economic Community has agreed to take something like 20,000 ton of Namibian beef. And so there are, one of the positives, I think, is the real positive feeling that generally there was in the world community about the way independence finally happened, and that it proceeded kind of according to plan and without major bloodshed right at the end, and that the constitution adopted in Namibia is one of the most progressive in the world, and also that SWAPO and President Nyoma have made some very comforting statements to prospective investors, to companies, saying we plan no immediate nationalization of the mines and so forth, that he has sought to reassure investors and mining companies. And speaking of that, there was a new gold mine opened at Karabib, just near the Lutheran Seminary. That's expected to bring in $60 million worth of foreign exchange each year. So that interested me, that there are new mines and so forth, that because in the last, two decades, South Africa has really run the mines night and day to try to get as much out.
Who controls it, so? Is it the big South African mining company?
I didn't get that impression.
It all depend, wouldn't it, on the fine print of the contract?
Well, I know that Namibia expects to get $60 million, and so that I assume means that they must have some control.
So, most of what you've been saying, in terms of the effect of the liberation and the republic being established in March, at the end of March, between then and now, the effect of having the freedom happen for most black Namibians has not changed their life, other than in their head saying we're free.
Other than in their head. I think that is probably true. I saw an article, I guess it was in the Minneapolis paper, saying that things aren't moving fast enough for the Namibian people. And I'm sure that's true. I heard a young Namibian student, one of these from on the Lutheran College program, very articulate guy who wants to be a lawyer, so we could train him and send him down. He said, I asked him the question, will people be patient long enough? And he said they will if it's explained to them. And for example, I think that's what this housing minister is trying to do, getting out into everywhere and just saying, I know it's bad, but this is what we can do. This is what we can do now. One of the things that, in terms of health, they have just launched the biggest immunization drive in the history of the country, and their goal is to have every Namibian child vaccinated by the end of 1990, which is a tremendous goal. And whether or not that can be achieved, that would have a very great effect.
Would you say that apartheid is about the same there as it is in South Africa?
It has been just about identical, yeah. It was the, you know, virtually the same system. The numbers given to the laws were in some cases different, but the laws were very parallel. The security laws, you could be arrested, you know, without charge and so forth.
So the new government, though, have they, like, the relationship to the whites, who still, quote, own the land, and all of, when a new country is established, I guess, today, what happens, I suppose, is that part of the negotiation with South Africa in terms of what the terms of the freedom were, in terms of what role did the whites play, what?
Well, the invitation is there for all people, white or black. It's to be a non-racial government, and anyone is welcome to stay in Namibia, welcome to become a part of nation building, to use their energies and their skills in building this nation. The farms, you know, and so forth, are not being taken from the white farmers. I assume, now in Zimbabwe, they had the phrase willing seller, willing buyer, or whatever. You had to, the farmer had to be willing to sell at an agreed upon price before any land was taken. And that really slows down land redistribution tremendously. And it means that people who are without land now are likely to be without land for quite a while. But it provides for a much more stable transition from minority to majority rule.
But they have a black president,
you know, and whites in the assembly now, in the house, in their parliament.
I don't know.
There are several. And there's one cabinet minister white, isn't there?
I thought maybe two. The minister of finance is white, and isn't the agriculture minister?
Yeah, that's right.
I think also white.
I was going to say on that, another positive, which you alluded to all the way along, the caliber of people in that government on the top level, I think you could stack up against any country in Africa and they'd be tops. Now the problem is in all the middle echelons where you don't have trained people, but the people that we know and the people we don't know in that government, and most of them are, many of them are active Christians, church-going involved, not that that makes you a good person, but they have those kind of, I think, that kind of ethic, that kind of, moral concern. And the people we know, many of them, well, both deputy bishops are in there. The deputy bishop from the north, Mata Madila, and Zephaniah Kameta, both assistant bishops of the two different churches are in the parliament. You have people like that and others. So that is a positive thing. If they now can be allowed to develop things and the people can be patient, I doubt if there's another place in Africa with a caliber of government of top.
I think you're right. And the other thing that I was going to say is a real positive in terms of reconciliation and in terms of how it's going to go is the role of the church. Because the church does cut across ethnic lines, and the church has been such a powerful actor in this whole independence process. They have been so actively involved and played such a leadership role that I think, you know, certainly we're going to run into sad, sad problems in Namibia, but I think, as Jim is saying, they have a much greater chance to make it more quickly than most of the other nations that became independent.
I'd like to suggest that they've got another great national asset, and that's Gwen Lister.
Gwen Lister is a white woman editor of the Namibian. She's been in Namibia, I don't know how long as I have known about Namibia, so at least 15 years. Absolutely courageous. I would not cross her for anything. Incredible. We've seen her in action, and she just sort of marches in. But
just a little pint of a lady who's
on very tall, high heels and swearing madly, and very, very bright and very, very honest.
She's German, or
she's She's from South Africa.
Aren't her folks South Africa?
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. That's a British name, I suppose, originally.
Yeah, and she has been so outspokenly critical of the whole South African time, and now she is really outspokenly critical every time SWAPO makes a misstep, and just the integrity that she has. And you just hope
What's her name again?
Gwen Lister, L-I-S-T-E-R.
And is she working in the news on a newspaper there?
She edits.
She runs that Namibian newspaper.
She runs the main newspaper in the country. There are, one of the differences between the struggle in South Africa and in Namibia is that in South Africa there have been many, many more whites actively involved. In Namibia, there were so few that you could almost count them on your fingers. And I know Zephaniah Kameta said the difference when he speaks in South Africa, he looks out, he sees whites. He said, we had Corpus Christi parade, one of the big church holidays, and it had a liberation theme, and he said there were two white sisters, white Catholic sisters, the rest were black. Well, there's Gwen Lister, the editor of the paper. There is John Liebenberg, a totally courageous, crazy flute player who is a world-class photographer and has just had, they both have had assassination attempts. The paper's been firebombed.
Just recently.
Again recently. Just consistently, but... They don't miss an issue of the paper, and they don't miss an issue, they don't keep quiet if they see, which, yeah, that is a real plus.
She isn't afraid to plow into the president, new president, yeah, and say, now, I want to find out about this.
The white person that had the highest position in the SWAPO organization, Anton Lebowski, a lawyer, was assassinated, 6 to 8 weeks before the election. A person who had just been very instrumental in drafting legislation and so forth.
Now, is that, do they know who did that?
I think they're pretty sure it was the civil co-